A few times this evening I was asked, is that supposed to be up there? I wonder if someone left that up there and you don't know about it. Well, actually, ask where I'm going to cut the lady in half. I've asked Vanna to join me up here because she's going to assist me. I have some show and tell as I go through the material I prepared for you. At first I thought, well, I could just continue on and pick up where Jeff left off in Mark. And I thought, that's pretty presumptuous, Dave. You don't want to do that. So I'm going to be reading from you tonight from John chapter 11, verses 32 through 44. And it's a passage I'm sure you're all very familiar with. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. And he said, Where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus began to weep. So the Jews said, See how he loved him. But some of them said, Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, already there is a stench, because he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus looked upward and said, Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Well, Lazarus lay dead in the tomb, and he was no longer bringing joy or comfort to his sisters and his friends. And he was no longer able to enjoy the intimacies of family or the pleasures even of a job well done. He had been anointed with oil, wrapped in the shroud of the dead, and sealed in the tomb. He was only capable of bringing tears to the mourners. Or was he? I've heard many sermons on these verses that concentrate on Lazarus' sister and his mourners. His sisters reacted to his death in the only way that was suited to their individual personality. Mary flitted around the mourners, sharing stories and eulogies. Martha busied herself in the kitchen, directing the maids and the helpers in preparing the food for so many family and guests. And they've all been here for 3 days, and she could expect them to be there for several more. And she probably wondered and complained that Mary was not helping again. Some of the mourners might have been sincere, but many were probably just simply paid professionals. They would go from funeral to funeral, putting on their best mourning clothes and faces. And they could be capable of instantaneous grief and tears. To them, one dead man was like another, a source of income and meals. And we can all relate to Mary, Martha, and the family who truly mourned the death of Lazarus. The official chest-beating mourners are a thing of the past now, and for most of us, we don't relate to them, and we can't find too much commonality. But I'm sure you've probably seen some of the quasi-official mourners. You know, the relative that always shows up at every funeral, clucking about and almost enjoying the occasion. All of those characters and Jesus' interaction with them are worthy of a sermon. But they are not the ones to whom I want to address your attention this evening. I want you to concentrate on Lazarus, for he is the one that I think that we are most like. Well, how is that, you say? How can I be resembling a dead man? He's been in the tomb for 3 days. And the passage tells us he probably stank of rotting flesh. We may not be physically dead, but I contend that we all are a little like Lazarus, spiritually dead, and the tomb is sealed. In 1979, the rock group Pink Floyd, how many remember Pink Floyd? Believe it or not, I have Pink Floyd CDs at home. I'm one of these weirdo 71-year-old guys that happen to like Pink Floyd. Well, they published an album called The Wall. And nearly all of the Floyd albums had a message to give or a story to tell in the lyrics and in the hard-hitting rock passages. You may have heard titles like The Far Side of the Moon or The Final Cut, as well as The Wall. In 1982, The Wall was made into a motion picture. Now, The Wall is actually a musical autobiography of the lead guitarist, Pink Floyd. It is the story of how he isolated himself from the world and from God. Brick by brick, he built his wall. Bricks of hatred, bricks of distrust, bricks of self-denial, bricks of drug abuse, eventually securing himself behind a wall of insanity. And I'm not suggesting that either you or I have reached the stage of despair that is epitomized by the wall. But we do wall ourselves in, and by doing so, we cannot do the work that God would have us to do. Like the pink, we build our walls one brick at a time. I'm going to offer some bricks to you and suggest that you consider which you might own yourself. Anger. Anger is a kind of physical influenza that incapacitates you just as a physical disease would. Anger is a choice as well as a habit. It is a learned reaction to frustration in which you behave in ways that you would rather not. In fact, severe anger is considered a form of insanity. Sometimes anger can fuel your resolve, but usually it does just the opposite. And I have a little story for you to demonstrate. Some of you may have heard this before, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. There was a Quaker with a particularly ornery cow. Every time he milked her, it was a clash of two wills. And this particular morning, she was unusually irritable. But he was determined to endure the session without so much as a cross word. As the farmer began to milk her, old Bessie stepped on his foot with all her weight. He struggled silently, groaned a little under his breath, pulled his foot free, and then sat back down on the stool. She then swished her tail in his face like a strong string whip, and he merely leaned away so she wouldn't be able to reach him. And next, she kicked over the bucket, which was by then, of course, half full of warm milk. He started over, mumbling a few words to himself, but never lost his cool. Once finished with the ordeal, he breathed a sigh of relief, picked up the bucket and stool, and as he was leaving, she hauled off and kicked him against the barn wall 12 feet away. That did it. He stood to his feet, marched in front of the cow, stared into those big brown eyes, and as he shook a long bony finger in her face, he shouted, "Thou dost know I am a Quaker, and thou dost know that I cannot strike thee back, but I can sell thee to a Methodist." Worry's another brick we sometimes carry around with us. You know, you can worry and fret about things so much that they simply never get done. The only thing that gets done is the worry part. I'm going to keep Helen on move here. Age. One of those other bricks that we carry around with us. You know, I'm too old to teach a Sunday school class. I'm too old to be working in the church kitchen. I'm too old to be able to relate to young people. I'm too old. I'm just too old. The 10-year-old little girl asked her grandmother, "Grandma, how old are you?" "Well, honey, when you're my age, you don't share your age with just anybody. Please, I won't tell." No, it's my secret." About 20 minutes passed, and the little girl bounced back in and said, "You're 62, and you weigh 180 pounds. Oh, well, the astonished grandmother, she said, "How in the world do you know that?" "Easy," she said. "I looked at your driver's license, and I did the math. And I saw that you got an F in sex." My grandmother suffered from acute arthritis. And in her later years, she was not able to do much beyond walk from the bed to an easy chair. And she passed away upon reaching her 96th birthday. But in spite of her disability, she never failed to send you a birthday card. They always had some personally written note or a message of hope and love. And she had instructed my aunt, with whom she lived, to continue sending out the cards that she had written after her death. And so for another year, beyond the pale, she continued to touch our hearts, and we continued to receive birthday cards. Revenge. You know, if you carry this brick around with you for a while, the load will simply be too much to bear. Revenge has been a subject that we've been talking about in our Tuesday morning men's study. And we know that the only person that revenge ultimately hurts is the one who carries around the brick. Ego. Now, here's one that I can relate to. You can't have that brick. It's mine. When I was in postgraduate school, my classmates gave me a little placard from my desk. It read, "It's hard to be humble when you're as great as I am." Pride goes right along with that ego brick. Maybe we should put them close together. They go together. Oh, okay. You know, nothing is more distasteful to God than self-conceit. This is the first and the most fundamental of sins. We love self instead of loving God. It enthrones us at the expense of God. Pride is a sin whose presence its victim is least conscious of. But if we're honest and measure ourselves by the life of our Lord, who humbled himself even to the death on a cross, you know, we can't but be overwhelmed with the shabbiness of our own lives and our own hearts. Let me share a little poem with you at this point, and you'll get to like this one, I think. Sometimes when you're feeling really important, sometimes when your ego's way up, Sometimes when you take for granted that you are the prize-winning pup, sometime when you feel that your absence would leave an unfillable hole, just follow these simple instructions and see how it humbles your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water. Put your hand in up to the wrist. Now pull it out fast, and the hole that remains is the measure of how you'll be missed. You may splash all you please as you enter and stir the waters galore, but stop, and you'll find in a minute it's back where it was before. Apathy. If you lived in New York City for a very long time, you know what apathy is all about. It's the ultimate condition of not caring, seeing someone injured on the street and walking right by. It is the two who passed by the injured man on the road to Samaria. Failure. Been there, done that, got the bruises to prove it. It's not easy to pick yourself up and try again after falling, but that is what it takes. If we fret over past failures, they become roadblocks to our future successes, whether in or out of the church. An assistant of Thomas Edison once tried to console the inventor over the failure to achieve in a series of experiments that he had set out to find. "It's too bad," he said, "to do all that work without results." "Oh," said Mr. Edison, "we have lots of results. We know 700 things that do not work." C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters vividly describes Satan's strategy. He gets Christians to become preoccupied with their failures. From then on, the battle is won. Danger. I'm always reminded of the TV series and a little boy yelling out, "Danger, Will Robinson," or is the robot, "Danger, Will Robinson, danger." You know, danger leads to the next brick, which is fear. And we all have fears, but it's how we deal with them that makes a difference. You've heard the expression, frozen with fear. Literally, not able to physically move because of fear. And that is usually associated with a deep-seated phobia like acrophobia. But fear can freeze us mentally and emotionally as well. We usually fear those things that we do not understand or we cannot perceive. I remember Halloween nights as a child, and this was in New York City, going out on pitch-black streets with my bag full of expectations, hoping it would come back with a full of candy. I always went out with a group that was for protection against marauders who would steal my candy. And after all, who knows what dark, evil spirit might be lurking in that dark patch of woods or in the storm drain, ready to leap out and grab you and your loot. By the time the evening's trick-or-treating was over, it was really dark. So we would return home back-to-back. Ever done that? Ever walk back-to-back? You know, one walks frontwards and the other one walks backwards. It looks like the four-armed, four-legged monster out of some science fiction thriller. But you wanted to know what was coming and what was going. Grief. The tears of grief are a cathartic that cleanse our mind and our soul. And grief is a necessary reaction to our loss. But it is easy to let grief become an addiction. Let it become the center of our existence. And when we hold on to grief in that way, we will find that we can hold on to nothing else. Successes. I should put more than one brick here. Nothing is quite as good as separating us from God as the flush of our own success. And we can become so inflated with our achievements that there's no room for anything else or anybody else. Handicaps. When we lived in New Jersey and again in West Virginia, I directed the choir. I really did. When I sang solos, and I enjoyed blending my voice with a gentleman named Ed. Ed and I did duets together all the time. I tried singing here in Hazel Green when we moved here, but how can you sing if you don't know if you're on pitch? And so now I just sing real loud from the pew. I really miss blending my voice with the other members of the choir or with somebody else as a duet or a trio. But my hearing loss is very severe in the high end. These hearing aids help, but they're only that. They're aids. They're not replacements. So I may be loud, but you may hear me off pitch. That's okay. I'm still singing praises to God. So I listen to God's calling to me in other ways. I had to give up the thing that I enjoyed before. Now, this story is a little old, but it's worth telling and hearing. Art Linkletter told of Wendy Stoker, who at age 19 was a freshman at the University of Florida. She was a young athlete, and she had placed third, just 2.5 points from first place, in the Iowa Girls State Diving Championship. She worked 2 hours a day for 4 years to get there. And now she's at the University of Florida, Art tells us. She's working twice as hard and has earned the number 2 position on the varsity diving squad. She's aiming for the national finals. Wendy carries a full academic load, finds time for bowling, and is an accomplished water skier. But perhaps the most remarkable thing about Wendy Stoker is her typing. She bangs out 45 words a minute on her typewriter with her toes. And then he says, "Oh, did I fail to mention? Wendy was born without arms." Solitude. I do this a lot in my office. You know, I'm uncomfortable around people sometimes, and they make me nervous. And they're always so demanding. Only some people are. And who needs friends anyway? I just like a good book and a quiet evening alone. The future is another brick we carry around sometimes. We need to be concerned about the future, because that is where we will spend the rest of our time. But the time that God has given us. But concern about the future and worry over the future are two different things. We may not want to take any action unless we are certain of the outcome. No risks allowed. We are all familiar with the story that Jesus told about the farmer who built bigger and better silos to secure the future. And perhaps he should have been a little bit more like Joseph, whose granaries were not for his personal benefit, but for those who depended on him. Here's a little twist on the parable of the farmer. A man walking on the beach found an old, worn magic lamp. When the genie answered his rub, he told him that the lamp contained but one remaining wish. The man pondered for a moment and requested a copy of the local paper's stock page, dated exactly 1 year post the date. In a puff of smoke, the genie was gone, and in his place was the financial news. Gleefully, the man sat down to peruse his trophy. He could invest with certainty, knowing the winners 1 year in advance. As the paper fell to his lap, it turned over to the obituary column found on the reverse of the page. And the name on the top of the listing caught his attention, for it was his. Yes, we need to be concerned about the future, but we need to live for today. God calls us to be his hands and feet, hearts and minds, today, not necessarily tomorrow. Work. I wonder how big this is going to get. Are you working more and enjoying it less? Don't raise your hand. We probably can all say that we have been in that situation at least once in our lives. Did you know that the only man who got all his work done by Friday was Robinson Crusoe? Most of us tend to worship our work, to work at our play, and play at our worship. We let their meanings and values become distorted Somehow, we seem to get the timetable that God gave us all mixed up. The seventh day was for rest and worship. For many, it is the day to cut the grass, either with a lawnmower or with a number 9 iron. Play and recreation are essential. They're essential to our physical and mental well-being. We really can't be good servants of God, nor companions in marriage, unless we fit in both. But play and recreation can become an obsession. I enjoy the challenge of creating computer programs. It is my mental recreation. But I often allow the pursuit of the optimum solution to a problem to become all-consuming. Helen knows when this happens better than I do. I can lose track of time and become oblivious to everything that's happening all around me. You know, so we each have these bricks of exclusion and the mortar of time with which we can seal ourselves away from the world and from those who are around us and from the Christ who stands outside the tomb. He stands there knowing that there's still life in the bones, still work to be done, still warmth in the heart to share with others. He stands there and calls out to us. He cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." And Jesus still cries out with a loud voice, "David, Helen, Paul, come out."